Hi, I'm Katie.
And I'm Chris, and this is the EdShift Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the EdShift Podcast. We are super excited to be joined today by Alex Gray. Alex has been a science teacher for more than 15 years, currently teaching at the Dubai British School, an RFU level 3 coach, and he holds, I'm going to get this acronym wrong, NPQLTLD, and an MA in education, where he really explored developing education through enhancing performance. Love that so much. And Alex, of course, doesn't stop there. Beyond that, because that's not enough, he's a content creator. In the realest sense, he hosts the International Classroom Podcast. If you're not listening to that yet, you definitely should. And he runs deepprofessional.com and shares content via deep teaching on YouTube. Alex, welcome to the EdShift Podcast.
Thank you ever so much for having me and inviting me along to come and speak to you guys today. I really appreciate it.
Tons and tons that we could dive into here, but let's start with your platform, Deep. So the word Deep in this case stands for develop, engage, explore, and progress. Yeah. Let's start there. Why those verbs when it comes to teaching and professional development?
So I will start with one thing, that my language skills, you give me far too much credit when you say verbs. I literally, during lockdown in Dubai, obviously probably like everyone else throughout the world, but during lockdown, we were sent home. I think it was about March the 11th, March the 12th. We took Easter 2 weeks early. So spring break 2 weeks early, was sent home. And over the course of that time, obviously every teacher was going through it in terms of developing new skill sets, and I was always hungry for professional development. And over the past few years, I'd sort of honed video skills, just because once you get a family, and I'd always been massively into photography, and I had these cameras and I'd videoed holidays, and funnily enough, the year before in 2019, we'd done a trip to Canada, had a family in Canada, and then we'd gone to Chicago as well. So we kind of always make sure when we go over that side of the world, because it's such a long flight from Dubai, we kind of make the most of it. So I had these videos and sort of developing these skill sets, and it dawned on me that actually as a professional development capacity that I was going to start content creating, because from that side of it, I was able to research. And obviously then you were really thinking about how you put these things across, how you were using them, giving examples. And I kind of just thought about, what is it that I would want? What is it that I want as someone who is going to offer value, or just for my own sake, what is it the type of things that I'm wanting to do? And so I really scratched my head and was trying to think about, right, I've had this idea of deep, and I needed to really figure out what it meant. And it wasn't necessarily to do with deep thinking or deep learning. It was just this word that really stuck out, and I got this develop. And then, right, what else do I want? Well, I want to engage and explore, and whether that's my engagement or my student engagement. And I think it's really important for educators, no matter what level they're at, is to be explorers and risk takers. And if you combine those three things together, you get progress. And my wife laughs at me about this, and she doesn't like it. And I'm probably the only person who says this to their kids, because everyone has this phrase, practice makes perfect. And as soon as someone says that to me, I just basically give them this cold stare. Like typical Paddington Bear, if you've seen the film, this cold stare. And I'm like, what's up? And my kids turn around, especially my eldest, and she's like, no, practice makes progress. And that for me, and it's not my saying, it's something that I've picked up on, but it's stuck with me for the past 5 years, because there's no such thing as perfection. And I think aiming for that, or saying like, keep practicing, guys, you'll be perfect. It's like, no, it's rubbish. If you practice, mm-hmm. you'll make progress. If you do these things, if you aim to develop and you explore and you engage with conversations like this or evidence-based research, or whatever it may be, you're going to progress. Now, progress could be minimal. It could be lots. It could be completely changing the way you do something. But for me, I think that is a huge characteristic of a lifelong learning skill. And that for me is what it stands for, you know, develop, engage, explore, progress. And I've kind of taken on a little bit further this year as well, where those characteristics lay the foundation for a lot of the things that I've done leading up to that. And it's only in the last year So it would be April 2023 that I really built the platform of Deep Professional, with the onus of being developing education through enhancing performance. So really trying to expand on what the terminology of Deep means. It still has this context of develop and engage and explore and progress, but now trying to really focusing on, well, I want to develop education. I want to develop educationalists. And for me, I've been in that many schools, having worked in the UK and now working internationally, where everyone talks about outstanding schools or outstanding leaders, outstanding teachers, and that was an outstanding lesson. And I'm just like, having been able to speak to enough teachers about it myself, I just don't like the term. I hate the term outstanding, because outstanding means you can be that in a snapshot. You know, you can have delivered an outstanding lesson, you know, because you can trick the approach. You know how to basically tick the boxes. And, you know, it's just a terminology that doesn't sit right with me in terms of being able to grade someone. And from coming from a sports background and going through coaching and all these different things, I just think performance for me is a much better term. And it's like, well, you hear these things about high performance, but performance is about consistency. And it's like, and for me, if I'm in a classroom, I'm working with teachers, it's like, you can ask them, what type of performer do you want to be? You can't ask them, what type of outstanding teacher do you want to be? It's like, so for me, the performance is a really more interesting metric and measure, because it's something you can strive towards. You're striving towards a consistent performance of what you do day in, day out, when nobody's watching, when nobody's grading, when it's just you and the kids, you know. And for me, then, this idea of it is a much more pertinent characteristic. So, yeah, the whole concept of Deep started with develop and engage and explore and progress, and is really built onto this idea of how can we develop educationalists through enhancing their performance. So the content and the conversations I have, and I always have to remind myself, but everything I try and do now is built around how can I enhance my own performance, and how can I work to therefore give something back that also enhances other teachers' performance.
That, I love the way you're thinking about that. And it makes me think, like, yeah, the idea of outstanding could be accidental. Almost, yeah. Right? Where performance is focused and mindful and purposeful, and getting to a result through, you know, through practice, and through those performance metrics. I think we probably don't think about that enough, but ultimately that's what we should be teaching students to do too. It's great to be outstanding on you know, one thing, or your field trip or your international day, but you know, it's really the performance that's going to help prepare them for what they're going to face in the world.
Oh, most definitely.
Interesting in context of like some of our students' expectations, right? In a land of like digital media and social media, our kids see all of these snapshots of outstanding. And thinking, you know, about my own 15-year-old daughter, like sometimes they get stuck there that they need to achieve that. But when we think about how dynamic the world is right now and how things are changing and how things like AI are coming in and, you know, potentially altering the way we work, really modeling for our kids and showing them that it is a continual process, and that you are striving for something, and then you are constantly acquiring new skills and trying new skills, and that it is this piece of lifelong learning. Like, I think that's so interesting and definitely something we need to be giving our teachers to support both them and the students that are relying on them.
Yeah, I mean, I was very fortunate to have a conversation last week, actually, at this Middle East Schools Leadership Conference. I get my acronyms right here as well. And there was a lady there from England, Hayley, is it Melanda? But we had a really interesting conversation that's on the International Classroom podcast. And she said about teachers should be real models, not role models. And I was like, well, that's interesting. What's the concept of real? And it's like, she said, someone just keeps it real. And that is someone from my, if I break that down from my side, just for what you've said, is about someone who is self-aware of how they feel and self-aware of what's going on around them, but is also open enough to be able to say, you know what, guys, not having a great day. You know, and we have this almost, the students come into the classroom and they're like, hey, sir, how are you? And I'm like, yeah, I'm okay. Thanks. How are you doing? And without even blinking, without even thinking about it, I'm like, yeah, I'm okay. And you should be able to go, you know what? And I've kind of started to do this a bit more now, where I've said, I'm just tired today, guys. And they're like, oh yeah, I'm a bit like that too. And it's like, oh, what's, and you can open the dialogue and have those conversations. And I think it's important, going back to the social media element, of recognizing that, yes, you know, what you're seeing there is something that could have been airbrushed and taken 30 times and heavily edited. You know, authenticity is probably the word that I would love. And I mentioned it this morning to an assembly for my students of sort of 14 to 16 year olds. And I said, this is the challenge. This is the question mark that will hang over your head for potentially the next 10 years about, is your work authentic? And it's a huge curse for them almost to have, that someone is going to question the authenticity of their work. And so, you know, with that, when you put stuff out on social media, it's being like, is this authentic? Have you written this? Or if it's a video like this, at least you can say there's a level of, or at least we used to be able to say there's a level of authenticity, because we're going to live in a world now where seeing is not believing. You know, we're seeing from the last few weeks about Sora, we've seen HeyGen, we've seen deepfakes, we've seen all these different things come through. And AI literacy, I think, is probably one of the most important things that we really need to be focusing on with schools. And what I mean by that is educating teachers and educating students and educating parents of, this is how to use AI, as well as, this is how AI works. And it's two very simple things. And it really should be at the forefront of every school leader, you know, wherever they are. And I know we've got this conversation about equity and equality, but the reality is it should be there, because our students are living in a world and going into this world where it's there and it's in everything. And there are some great stories coming out about it, and there are some really scary coming out about it. Especially, I think someone posted something about how now students are using AI to bully other students, because you just take an image of, and I said this to mine, take an image of someone, and all of a sudden you can just go, right, put it onto this body, do this, and AI will do it for you. And you can then just send that around. And I go, that's me, but that's not me. I didn't do that. I wasn't posing like that. That's not. And we've seen it in Spain. We've seen it across UK and America and all these different places. And, you know, they're living in a hard enough world as it already is, with the pressures of social media and what it means how do you have to look and how do you have to be. And it's interesting, from someone like myself who is a content creator and loves YouTube, how many creators are starting to come off YouTube and come off these platforms. And I'm sure there's going to be a reason for it that's probably deeper than just, it's burnout, it's this. I think there's probably more to it, to some extent, about social media pressures and keeping up and having all these things. It makes things very challenging for students, and at the same time, that makes things exceptionally challenging for educators and parents of, how do you create self-awareness and how do you create this idea of self-worth and value and all these social and emotional well-being characteristics that we want, but also recognize that those things are developed through struggle and strife and uncomfortableness. It's not something that just comes along with sunshine and roses all the time, is it?
Yeah, there's all that hard work, the blood, sweat, and tears that gets you there in the process. And we don't always see enough of that, for sure.
Yeah, I think the term is sweat equity, isn't it?
What are a couple pieces of advice you would give, or skills you would say focus on this for educators who are saying, like, yeah, I know this exists, I know I need to do something about this, but I need to teach my curriculum and I need to make sure my test scores are good, and like, how do I do this? What would you tell them?
I think there's three tiers where we're at the moment. I think there's people, the early adopters, and like, so I would class myself as that, and I sit in quite a niche environment with people across LinkedIn and the platforms, my professional learning platforms that I use. And you think there's loads of people out there using it, and there really isn't. You're very much niche in that respect. And so there's that top end of it who are trying to drive it and thrive with it, and, you know, or seeing or dancing, and that's okay there. And then there's the middle ground, the people that are, like you just said, want to do this, and I'm kind of okay with it, but I'm not too sure, where should I go? And there's people underneath it who are just like, no, not interested. And that's also okay. And so my advice would be, if your scores are good, if your results, and this is the thing, if your results are graded, as we can kind of go through and going back to this, if your results are graded as in terms of, look, your class are performing above their predicted, or the value added that you're giving them is great, then your methodology of teaching is working for that class. You know, the value you're giving them and the engagement and the learning for that subject is excellent. Keep doing what you're doing. you know, if you're interested in therefore going, right, you know what, I want to upskill myself. I want to see what this is about because I think it could add another dimension or another string to my bow, or bring in little Jimmy who sat over there, might be a little bit disengaged. Then my advice would be start with ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini. Those are the three heavy hitters. You've got Gemini, that is Google's, used to be Bard. That's really, really good. You've got ChatGPT, which is obviously the lead horse, as it were, in this race. And then you've got Claude. And those are kind of the three main models that a lot of people would be using. And there are other experiments. There are other ones on the periphery, is there. But I think just as a starting point, go with those. And I would actually just say the best way I use it, and I probably use it very, very simply, is I like to ideate with it. Because, for example, it's fantastic because it's trained up to probably some of them 2021, but some of them trained up to 2023. If you think about where is all the evidence-based research or the evidence-based pedagogy that we use as educators, when was it all done? And you go in, oh, wow, you know what? We still use Rosenstein's principles. And when we go, okay, when was that done? Well, that's going to be in the memory banks because it was almost, what, 30? I'm guessing, but it was a long time ago. And then you can go, right, what else do we use? What are the frameworks? Oh, I might use Bloom's taxonomy. That's still there for having questioning. Years ago, that's going to be in the framework. What are the parts? And if you don't know, just go, hey, ChatGPT, what are the main pedagogical practices that I could, and just say, list me 10. And I've done that. It came up with like even like things like Doug Lemonoff's Teach Like a Champion was in there. It's like, and it had things like, right, was it things like behavior? And it had things like questioning, and it had things like dealing with feedback. And you go, maybe I should learn a little bit about that. And you can ask it. You can ask ChatGPT. So you can use it to help, first of all, improve your pedagogical and your PD. So it's fantastic in getting access to those things. And then go, right, you know what, actually, I'd like to use a bit of Rosenstein's principles in my lessons. Maybe I don't. And I was having this debate today and some news about, you know, do we need to use explicit instruction or should it be, you know, student-led learning? It's like there's always that divide and go, well, maybe I'm going to try it, but I don't know how to do it. And we're seeing that with project-based learning at the moment. And just ideate and go, you know what? I want to do a project on this topic. I've got a class of this many. This is my students. Could you help me just come up with some ideas for me? And literally that is how I talk to ChatGPT. That's why I type to ChatGPT. And then I'll prompt chain. And what I mean by that is it'll come back with some things. And I'll go, that's really good. Could you actually just elaborate on point two to do with this? And it'll go, yeah, sure, Alex, blah, blah, blah. Amazing. That's great. Thanks. Now I want to write a brief for my students so they understand what's going on. And just that idea of ideation and just to generate something like a project based or like something like, oh, I don't know, questioning from Rosenstein's. And you can go, oh, just create me some questions that fit into this fifth principle. Maybe use Bloom's or maybe use higher order thinking. And I'm doing it on this topic about the heart. And I know that. I'm confident with it. So therefore, it could go, right, I understand that. Those are really good questions. Maybe not that one. I'll pick those. And, you know, as long as even if 75% of it is golden, still better than nothing. And you've used it therefore in a more effective and efficient way. And actually, I think for 80%, even not all educators out there as a starting point, that's the best way to do it. Even for me today, like I was teaching my year eight class and then my guinea pig class. They're not an exam group. Year eight from an English or British curriculum side is sort of what would be, I think it's grade seven for IB. It's basically 12-year-olds to 13-year-olds. No exams. So they're the guinea pig. I can try things with them. I can use platforms with them that maybe I wouldn't do straight away with my exam groups. And I was saying, right, we're teaching about the nervous system. And I'm like, right, you know, I need some scenario based. I need some real world examples. So I love throwing that in. I just say to ChatGPT, it's like, here are my learning outcomes. Can you create five different real world examples for me to pick from that I can use? And it comes through it. And it's like, one of them is design a multi-sensory park. It's like, perfect. This is, we're in Dubai. And you just say, right, I love this one. Can you just elaborate on it for me a little bit and then create this brief for students? And they're from 12 to 13-year-olds. They're mixed ability. They've got access to the internet and, you know, do this. And it came up with it. And literally the brief was design a multisensory park for people who struggle with, you know, visually impaired and hearing impaired or sensory overload and all these different things. You're going to use, you know, it's going to be this section of the park. You can do it digitally. You can do it on paper. This is the time. And it was amazing. And the kids did it. Absolutely loved it. And because of that, they've got a real world application of how what they've learned in science could be applied to the real world. Whereas if we're just always focusing on rote learning, if we're just focusing on recall all the time, then we miss out on this opportunity of, well, actually, how does this apply? Because I cannot be the only teacher out there in the world where students go to them, yeah, but sir, why do we need to learn about this? I'm never going to use it in the real world. And so my advice would be, you know, if you, even if you don't want to use it, it's still fine. If you do want to use it, just keep it simple. Think things that you know about that you do all the time in your class, whether it's a starter, whether it's recall activities, whether it's interleaving, maybe dual coding. We see that in Cog Science a lot. Or you're going to go, you know what, I want some real world examples. I want something that my kids can start then applying what we've done. You know, I want to give them problems, or I want to give them projects. You know, and it's great for that. And you can just have a conversation with it. And before you know it, you're hooked in going, I never thought of doing that. I would on my own have never have thought of doing that. Like I would never have thought of doing asking my students to design a multisensory park. And so those types of things, I think, are really, really useful with it. And then you're always going to get people who are at the forefront who are still sprinting, you know, and going, oh, Sora could be doing this and we can import HeyGen this and all these things. It's like, yeah, you could do, but the reality is 95% of teachers are not going to do that because there's cost. That's going to obviously close the door on a lot of things. And also, I don't need to be doing those things to have my students engaged and for them to be liking and loving my subject and being successful, or in this case, high performers in my subject. You know, I still need an idea of human connection. I still need to facilitate and move around. And I think this idea of teachers being petrified and scared and school leaders being scared and parents being scared, it's just, I think, shifting to a hybrid model. We're going to do a little bit of this, but you know what? You still need to come back and talk to me. You still need to give space to answer my questions, because this communication skills will never go away. You know, if you want to dive into authenticity, the only way to really then be authentic is a face-to-face conversation. Tell me what you know, like we're doing right now. And you can sell that authenticity about it and go, you know what, you really do know what you're talking about. And that's why we have these conversations and we talk about leaving space for people. And it's very simply, someone said, it's like, let the people who know about it talk about what they know. And I think that's a really important thing for students then, as they move forward and go, well, if you don't know about this, then you don't know what you're talking about. And I think if we can then try and embellish those skills and develop those skills so they do know, or at least they know something, then they're able to talk about what they know, and we get this idea of authenticity. And again, you could still design that with ChatGPT. Hey, I've got this debate I want to do. Can we do this? Can you come up with these ideas? So the synergistic learning, it should just be very, very simple. Very simple ideas, very simple conversations, ideate to create something that you probably would not have thought about on your own, or allow it to be more efficient for you, where you can build in things that you've already done, and then you get accustomed to it, you feel safe with it, and there's so much more that you can expand upon.
There's so many powerful things to pull out of what you just said there, because I really like how you're positioning AI as kind of an ally, a support for teachers, like not something they have to be afraid of, but something they can work alongside of. And then the skills that students are developing by having those experiences in class, right? Critical thinking, mm-hmm. like looking at what they're getting and analyzing it. Collaboration, and collaboration in a way that looks not just at collaborating with their peers, but collaborating with AI. So as this becomes more prevalent and starts to appear in their workspaces in the future, they know how to interact with it, to learn from it, and to continue to kind of ideate upon that and bring their unique human aspects to it. And so I think there's so much happening there that we kind of need to get our toe in the water and start doing it. But I like how you phrased it, because it seems very approachable to just about any teacher. Like, hey, here's this thing that can help you do what you're doing. You're exhausted. It's 10 o'clock at night. You're planning your lessons. Here's this resource you can go to. And it is not doing it for you. It is not replacing you. But it is really like making it more efficient, making it more effective, giving you things you haven't thought of in a way that then really helps you develop students to go out and do the things they'll have to do in a world that is really changing all the time.
And I think with that, it comes an element of inspiration, because you're not just then recycling the same lesson after the same lesson and doing the same thing that you've always done before. That ability to go, you know what, I've got this lesson, like let's try and reframe it in a different way. And again, because students' needs are also becoming very different in this world, and what they've also got access to therefore go through the learning process is also very different. And there's still going to be needs for like reading and writing and having those things. But, you know, as I've learned, as I've gone through my journey, the value of knowledge is decreasing. And it really is. Like, and I'm the same. If I don't know something, it's like, just bear with me, guys. I'll just check it up. You know, we used to do it. It's like, let me just ask Siri. Let me ask Alexa. Let me just Google it. And now it's just like, oh, let me just find out for this. So the value of knowledge in that respect, and it's even if you work in education, the idea of it, I don't expect people to know everything. I don't expect to know everything anymore. And people are becoming more comfortable and complicit with this idea of, I'll just search it up. Don't worry about it. I'll just find it out. And then it's the ability to make sense of that. And that in itself is the skill. That shows understanding, the skill to find the knowledge, the understanding to obviously make sense of it, and then the skill set to be able to then regurgitate or pass that off or communicate that side over. And that's, from my side, I think why it's an old one, it's an old framework, but I still love TPAC, technological, pedagogical, and content knowledge.
I want to pivot a little bit. We've talked about students a lot, but you are, you know, working in secondary school, teaching science to kids who are going to graduate and go off into the world. And I think, you know, as a science teacher myself, like, how over the past 15 years have you kind of shifted and evolved your thinking on what are you trying to accomplish in teaching these learners? Like, what do you need them to understand about science to go out into the world? I think from my perspective, I am always taught in kind of inner city schools with underprivileged populations and the kids who definitely are like, Miss A, what does this have to do with my life? Right. And so, I was always very reflective on what do they need to know? Like, how will science impact them? What do they need to walk away from school understanding to go out into the world? And as knowledge has become less important and other skills have evolved, like what does your ideal graduate look like in the skills they've learned in science?
So I would like to think that ones coming out of my class are definitely critical thinkers, are creative. But I think the real world skill that I would probably want and talk the most about them is analytical. And even if they're 18-year-olds and they're doing A-level biology and they're going to go off and they're not even going to do a science-based course, some do, some want to do medicine, and I've got my different opinions on those things as well. But it would be to be analytical. And what I mean by that, I'll give you a story. So my wife turned around to me a couple of years ago and she said, did you know that women need more sleep than men? She goes, I came across this in a science journal. I was like, and by that point I was like, okay, amazing. And my heart started ticking away and I was like, so whereabouts did you get this? And she went, a science journal. I said, where? She went, on Facebook. And as soon as she said that to me, I was just instantly like, right, okay, no. However, as time's gone on and you start to see the evolution of education over 15 years, as I pose this question to my students, and it's something I found, and I said, well, where do you consume your news? Like, if you were to find something, if you were watching news, if you were trying to figure out what's going on in the world, what platform are you using to consume that? And obviously, on the day, like, we would obviously use the radio or we'd use the TV, and there was designated times for TV. And then obviously with the internet came along, you could easily just pick up news 24 hours. And they're all, and I said this stat to them as well, and they're like, yeah, probably on social media. And I said, yeah. I said, 3 billion people in this world, 3 billion will consume their news through social media. And they're like, yeah, they will. And I was like, so is all of that news correct? And they looked and they went, I don't know. And it's like, and that is the skill set I want you to walk away with, so that when you are finished with school and finished with your education, science or not, is that you will look at something with an analytical part and go, I don't know if I believe that. I don't know if that's right. You know, where is the case study done? What's the evidence? And all these different things. And I'll give you an example, like even just the other day, like from my own podcast, I was very fortunate to speak with a leader in Mexico doing fantastic things with VR. And he said, and I put this one out there, he said, based on my research, which is coming from consultancy companies, you know, learning through VR is 4 times faster. Is there or thereabouts that line? And I put it out there and loads of people came back and went, not buying that data. And And I, well, hang on a minute. He's quoted it from his research. Let's see where that research is. Let's be, you know, because we want to avoid pseudoscience. And so it's like, right, here it is. Here's the one of them's in ERIC. One of them's on ResearchGate. Oh, PwC did one. And it's all saying those things. So in this gentleman's research, which is what he's come across, this is what the stats are saying to him. And everyone's like, well, you know, I'm really well versed in this. I've read this. I know this. I was like, and that's fine. We're here to have a conversation about it. That's the whole purpose. Where's the evidence to support for your, you know, rebuttal to refute this claim? And this person went, well, I'm not going to link to anything else, but in my own experience. And I was just like, oh my God. And you're, and this person was a scientist. And I showed my colleagues at school who are like PhDs in biochemistry and all this. And they were just shaking their heads, said, this is the world we're living in. When someone goes, but in my humble opinion, and it's like, no. I've given you facts and figures. I don't want your opinion on this. I want you, you know, to be able to go, well, I think this is wrong because, and here's the evidence. And so for mm-hmm. students with the world that we're coming into as well, with even with this again, this reiteration of authenticity, it's like, you know, people throw statements out there all the time. I want them to be able to say and go, right, I've read something, but I don't know if it's right or wrong. They didn't have the data. They didn't have this. I'm not just going to believe it outright. I'm going to go, right, actually, no, this is wrong. This is like, you know, and it feeds into everything that we do with our lives, you know, whether it's the food we consume, you know, and these, you know, these different companies release different things or different governments say, you know what, don't drink milk. It causes cancer. And that came out years ago. I remember this. And it's like, okay, where's the evidence for this? And it's like, you know, and then they go, the famous one, it's always easy to do is, oh, you know what, cell phone towers, they're fine. They're not going to do any harm. And you say to the students, great, who funded that research? And it'd be like a telephone company. And they're like, yeah, still think it's biased. And it's like, so it's having that ability to look at information and stories, whether it's what they read in the newspaper, what they read in a magazine, or what they consume on social media across their phones, that they don't just believe it as read. That it isn't a case of seeing is believing now. It's like, as we already said, seeing is not believing. It's what's the evidence for this? You know, how many people, what was the case study sample size? You know, should I actually be eating? Should I be a vegan? And that's always a great debate point, you know, and it will have this from there. Or it's like, and everyone goes, I know. It's like, oh, no, but sir, I watched Game Changers on Netflix. It's like, amazing, completely biased, but amazing. And it's like, let's have a conversation about this. Like, let's do some other parts and really, you know, go through it. And they're like, oh. And it's like, did you know, here's some evidence that, you know, one of them said, you know, if you eat red meat, sir, it decreases the chance of, I think it was Alzheimer's in the brain. And it's like, what? And other kids are like, oh, no, but there's only like, and so they're now having a conversation about evidence and they're using the evidence to support their claims. And it's like, that's what should be driving your values and, well, more your beliefs, you know, in terms of like, I've read this and yeah, there's evidence to support that. And so therefore I can be confident to an extent that, you know, there is some truth in it. It may not be perfect, but there is some truth in it. And I think for the world they go into now and what they do, if they can walk away and to be able to think analytically, to not just take something that's, you know, at face value, it's like, yeah, it's great. That's what I want them to walk away with.
Yeah, I'm struck by the fact that, yeah, when I, in my own educational experience, I think the realm of learning how to think critically and be analytical was like, you go to university to do that. You go to college to do that. That was, you know, and I remember taking that away from my post-secondary experiences. And that was, you know, a lot of what I learned, but the idea that the world is moving at such a faster pace now than it was a minute ago when I was in high school and university, that we have to teach kids in high school and I would argue even younger how to have more of that discerning look at the world. And one could argue we might be in a different place societally if we were doing that more, you know, 20 years ago. But, you know, but here we are, and it gives me so much hope that we have the opportunity to teach students younger how to do this. So thank you, Alex, so much for such a good conversation. I think so many things that I'm going to go away thinking about this, and hopefully other people are as well. And it the ways that we are hopefully building, you know, stronger, better, more resilient, critical thinking global citizens. Like I said, it makes me feel hopeful in a time where sometimes watching the news doesn't have that effect. But with that in mind as well, one final question for you, Alex, that we like to ask our guests, and that is, what has been the best part of your day today?
See, I'm very lucky. You've caught me on, we had this conversation obviously at the start, very lucky today, because today at my school was International Day. So for those people watching and listening that might be a foreign concept to, is that in international schools, we are blessed with, I think my school has about 60, almost 60 different nationalities in there. And we celebrate that. And I think it's a wonderful thing to do. And so for where my lab is, I look out the window and there's this huge parade that starts the day. So all the different nationalities, students in their traditional dress or colors or representing their countries, they all come around, they all, you know, walk out and you get to see them. There's flags, there's all sorts there. And they're very therefore, you know, proud of where they've come from. Even though we're all here in this cultural melting pot that is Dubai, they're very proud of that. And I think it's important they have this heritage. So it just kind of one of those things we talk about, fill your bucket. It's from a social, emotional well-being perspective. It's great. I love seeing that. My children are involved in that. And so for me, I'm very proud of being English. It's not always perfect, but, you know, I'm proud of my heritage. I'm proud of, you know, where my family's from. But I'm also very happy to have family that have emigrated and moved. I have a family in Canada. We then have cousins and family that live in Italy. And then we are here based in Dubai. And so the ability to have that little kind of dip your toe in to what is maybe normal life for others, where you're getting to try Egyptian food or Palestinian food or Lebanese food or Italian, French, we had Spanish, I think it was Polish, everywhere, you know, all these different countries you can think of. Yeah, for someone who likes to eat, which I do, it was absolutely amazing.
Thank you for sharing that with us and thank you for being here, Alex.
No, thank you. I've probably done the typical teacher thing and just enjoyed speaking and rambling on. So thank you for giving me the platform to exercise my voice in that way. I very much appreciate it.
We will stick all the links to where you can find Alex online in the show notes. Definitely check out the International Classroom podcast, probably available wherever you're listening to this podcast, and lots of other ways to get in touch with us and with Alex. If you enjoyed the conversation today, leave us a review. If you didn't, why are you still listening? Thank you for listening to the podcast. And we look forward to seeing you next time on EdShift. Have a great day.